Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and you're listening to Stages, the podcast that converses...
The reality of that eight-show-a-week slog is really hard.
When I start on a character, I have to draw them, and I'm not an artist.
This is, in effect, built in myth and mystery.
So you'd be sitting in this tiny little bio box with radiators all around you.
Which was a funny thing, because I don't think that play would have happened in that way if it wasn't at Griffin.
You're a bit different to the other girls in this area.
Yes, I thought, yes, I am.
That was the days when they could smell an actor or a singer and think, oh, I've got 6 weeks.
My sisters really taught me that I had to be versatile.
This ostrich, pink ostrich feather sticking up out of my hair, out of this wig.
My first career, as it were, was preparation for my second career.
And her face was beaming. It was just beaming at me.
I hadn't lost any of my passion or love for it, so it's been a joy to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Peter Ayers, and welcome to Stages, the podcast that converses with creatives about craft and career. One of the delights of hosting the Stages podcast is conversing with a range of artists across many disciplines. The elders of the profession have so much anecdote and experience to share. Equally exciting is conversing with emerging artists. The passion for their craft and the anticipation they hold for the career ahead is always inspiring and exciting. A young actor not long out of training at the Victorian College of the Arts and who is establishing himself as a talent to watch is Anthony Yangoyan. Making his mark in the Griffin Theatre productions of Dogged and Jail Baby, he is presently on stage with a company of actors delivering The Dictionary of Lost Words at the Sydney Theatre Company. Anthony sat down with Stages to reflect on his career thus far, his craft, and his desire to make great art. 455, who would have thought it'd be with you?
Are we recording?
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
Look at you come alive.
Thank you for having me.
That's all right. What's Hot Wings? What were you talking about?
Hot Wings is it's a YouTube show where this guy called Sean something eats a bunch of hot wings with all these famous people.
What, and asks them takeaway food hot wings?
Yeah, takeaway food hot wings. Right. And he asks them questions, and the questions get more and more difficult as the wings get hotter and hotter.
Right.
So yeah. Sometimes it's a good episode, sometimes it's not, but yeah, it's pretty interesting.
I'll have a look.
Yeah, you should incorporate that in these.
What, are you looking forward to some difficult questions?
Not really, to be honest. The easier the better, but you know.
You've always been able to spin your way out of...
That's actually very true, but sometimes I dig my own grave, so we'll see how we go today. Right. But you can always cut it out, as you said, so...
Well, I may not.
Okay, all right.
All right. We'll see what comes out of it. Anthony Yangoyan, look, it's been joyous to see your progression in the industry, your career develop over the last couple of years. It's been very exciting to watch. And I talk to all sorts of people on this podcast, as you know, because you did your homework last night and realised.
Yes, I did.
So it's really nice to talk to an actor who's just starting out. And is in the early stages of what I believe will be a very rewarding career for you. So
thank you, I appreciate that.
No worries. You're currently performing on stage, of course, in the Dictionary of Lost Words, which started in Adelaide, premiered, and you've got the Sydney season now, and then you go to Melbourne next year.
Yeah.
Who do you play in that?
I play two characters. I play a character called Bill, which is one of the lead's love interests. He sort of disappears at the end of Act One, and then I play another character that works in the scriptorium, and he's an older man called Mr. Malling, and he's quite interesting to play and fun as well. They're both really fun and interesting to play, but I've never really played an older character in a professional setting, so it's been good to work with that. It's been exciting.
The scriptorium, of course, is the office where the...
Where the Oxford Dictionary was made.
Being developed.
Yeah, which is what the play's about, but also the play's... I would say it's a coming-of-age story about this girl named Esme who essentially puts together her own dictionary of lost words that all relate to women. So it's quite a feminist story, which is fantastic. And all the male characters in the play act as a support for that storyline, that narrative. Yeah. It's a terrific, quite funny as well.
Terrific play. I found it very engaging. I went the other night. I hadn't read the book, of course. It's a very popular book.
Yes.
But quite an entertaining stage narrative. It's long, in 3 hours, which is nothing really, because that's the well-made play was often 3 hours long.
Yeah.
You know, it's only in sort of recent decades that our concentration span has perhaps got shorter, and we're seeing plays that are one act and go for 90 minutes or just under. So it can be challenging for audiences to sit there for 3 hours. However, this play is absolutely compelling. There are moments where you have extended periods off stage.
Yes.
What are you doing?
Well, I don't have long enough off stage to sort of zone out completely. I might be off stage for 10 or 15 minutes at a time, then I'll come back in to do maybe like move a prop or set another scene up, because it's quite an ensemble piece. So when we're not acting or delivering lines as characters, we're doing other things on stage as well. But sometimes, which is probably a little bit naughty of me, but I eat my dinner. Mm. So in between, there's a big break in between act. During act two, I'm off for maybe 20 minutes. And because the show finishes so late, I might scoff some dinner down and then go back on stage, which is something I've never, ever done. But yeah, you got to use your time wisely.
Yeah.
And then other than that, I'll just talk to just keep the conversation up with other actors backstage, just to keep the energy going. I don't really like to switch off, because then you feel like the show's finished. So we're constantly just talking, really. There's not much else you can do.
So having your dinner in act two.
Yeah.
What's your normal practice with the show? Do you like to eat before the show, or?
I think it depends. Right? Depends what the show is, really. It depends what time the show starts as well, and how long the show goes for. So this show's super, super long, so I'd rather eat before or during, if I've got a choice. But if it's a show that I've got a lot to do in and I feel quite nervous about, I won't eat beforehand. I just can't. Mm. Also, it just makes me feel heavy, and then you sort of go into a bit of a food coma.
Yeah.
And I like seeing the food as a reward at the end. It's like, okay, you do the hard work, go to work, do your work, and then eat at the end.
Yeah. It's maintaining that focus when you're off stage. It just reminded me when I was early in the career doing An Ideal Husband by Oscar Wilde.
Yeah.
And I had periods where I was off stage, and I just got my first mobile phone. And you get nowhere, this is going, don't you? And I was in the dressing room talking to somebody on the mobile phone, and on the stage, it was the stage management saying, you're on, you missed your cue.
Yeah.
I never did it again.
Yeah.
You know, it's
It's dangerous. We're lucky because we have speakers in our dressing rooms that tell us when we actually have to be on. If we're off,
and you're called to the stage.
And we're called to the stage if we're off for extended amounts of time, which is a lifesaver. Because if that didn't exist, I'm sure I would have missed many, many cues.
Yeah.
But
once lights up, curtain up at the start of the show, I mean, for the duration of whatever the performance is, you are on high alert, aren't you? You've got to be.
Yeah, 100%.
To stay tuned with the...
100%. You can't switch off. And also because things go wrong on stage as well. Like, it's live theatre. So even though we are off for extended amounts of time, when we're back on, you might have to improvise. Something might go wrong. You might have to improvise. Someone might drop a line. You might drop a line. Someone might say something a little differently. You might have to respond a little differently so that part of the play makes sense, which is the great thing about theatre. It all happens in the moment. You can't do it over again, and which is why I think it's so nerve-wracking. Even when you've done so many shows, there's still a little bit of nerves underneath you. And also, you kind of have to stay on, because if you go too much into an autopilot mode, you get too comfortable, you get too relaxed, and then you might mess up, which happens a lot. People are like, I've never done that before, and it's the 17th show, and it's because they've probably just gotten too comfortable.
It's exciting when things go wrong.
It is.
But as long as the audience don't know.
Audience doesn't know, generally, but yeah, it is. It is exciting. Keeps you on your toes. It's good.
So Dictionary is going off to Melbourne in 2024, isn't it?
Yes.
You're playing a season at the Arts Centre.
Yep.
Which is exciting.
Do 3 weeks at the Arts Centre, and then a potential fourth week if it gets extended, if it sells well.
This is your first tour, I guess?
I've done a tour, like not a big, this is probably my first big tour, but I've done regional tours of shows before. I did one at the beginning of 2022 called King of Pigs, and that went to a bunch of regional towns, regional New South Wales, and Tassie as well. And that was really fun. That was great. But that wasn't as long. That was only for a month.
Touring's great, isn't it? You get to see a bit of the country. And...
Oh, absolutely. I see places where I wouldn't have otherwise seen or gone to. Like, I probably wouldn't ever have gone to Hobart if it wasn't for that show, King of Pigs, or Wagga Wagga. But loved all of them. They've been all great places.
Had you been to Adelaide before?
I'd never been to Adelaide before, no. Yeah, so that's another one for the dictionary. So
great capital cities.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was acting something you always wanted to do?
I think so, yeah. I think, well, I went to a performing arts school, which you taught me at. So for all the
full disclosure.
For all the viewers, Peter was an old teacher of mine.
Viewers?
Sorry, listeners.
People are sitting there.
The listeners.
Looking at their phone.
All the listeners.
All the listeners, yeah. Yeah, yeah, we did. Yes, full disclosure. Anthony and I have had a relationship in a previous life as teacher-student.
Yeah. Yeah. I think... So that was always a passion of mine. I've always loved performing. And I guess as a child, it was always just about being the centre of attention, like it is for a lot of kids, and getting a bit of energy out. So
what's your earliest memory of performing? Was that, you know, being a show-off at home?
At home.
Yeah.
Actually, my earliest memory of performing was probably... I used to go to the drama classes in this place in Broadway called Keen Kids, years and years ago. I don't know if they exist anymore. And... I was probably like 8 or 9, and that was probably my earliest memory of performing in front of an audience, and that was quite exciting. Yeah.
What excited you about that? What was the?
I think I just loved. I think I liked. Well, at that point, it was I loved making people laugh. Mm-hmm. So that's something I did a lot as a kid. I loved making people laugh. I loved being the funny guy, and I think being able to do that on stage in front of so many people was super rewarding. Yeah.
What makes you laugh?
Really silly things. Really silly things. I think you know I laugh at really stupid things. I'm not very mature, so it doesn't take a lot to make me laugh.
Well, no, you aren't very mature. I have to say that. You've grown up a lot.
Definitely.
But there's nothing wrong with having an immature sense of humour.
No.
Which I have as well.
Yeah.
And I'm
old.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. Well, it's either really clever humour, so really, really clever humour, or humour that catches me off guard completely. So they're probably my two favourite sort of things to laugh at. I don't love dark humour, actually. As I'm getting older, I'm finding dark humour.
Black comedy.
I like black comedy, but dark humour, like, you know, I won't do any jokes right now on this podcast. About certain subjects, that people find funny.
Yeah.
And I don't know. As I'm getting older, I genuinely just don't find it funny. And if I were to laugh, it'd just be because I'm uncomfortable and I don't want them to feel uncomfortable. So I'll just laugh at it.
They do that. They explore that dark humour, I guess. Is it sort of a catharsis, a way of coping with, you know, heavy themes?
Definitely for some people, I think. Yeah, 100%. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it.
Yeah, it just doesn't rock your boat.
No, not anymore. I don't know why. It's been a recent thing. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
So I guess I'm changing.
So a performing arts high school. You were obviously drawn to that because as part of that education, you got to hopefully develop some acting chops.
Yeah, we were very, very privileged in that I got 2 hours a day of performing arts. So it was extracurricular stuff. It wasn't part of, like, we still did English, math, all that sort of stuff. But we just got to do it during school hours, which was fantastic. Whereas a lot of kids that did performing arts during high school had to do it externally, you know, go to a dance school or go to a drama school after, or, you know, do ATYP classes or NIDA classes or whatever it was. But I got all of that at school, which was fantastic. And I got it every day, so I was very, very lucky. Yeah.
And being in that environment also, you find your tribe, don't you? Other like-minded kids who also have similar desires and ambition and... you know, you were there with some terrific kids who have gone on to make their mark. People like Aisha Madden. And
Aisha's a good friend of mine.
On Heartbreak High.
Yep.
And
I've got a few other friends that went on to study at schools as well, at VCA, NIDA, WAPA as well. So it was nice. It sort of like continued the community after high school because we were all so like-minded, which is pretty rare because a lot of people don't talk to people from high school. But we got lucky in that we all sort of wanted to follow the same path. well, a percentage of us did anyway.
It's good to establish those lifelong friendships.
Yeah.
So what else did you get out of that high school experience?
It was just a really supportive environment. I got to grow into who I am, like, completely authentically, without any pressure from I guess, you know, the outside world or other kids, because it was such a welcoming environment that you just grow into yourself in your own time and be who you are pretty much unapologetically, because the school allowed that, which is a very rare experience. A lot of people have negative high school experiences. I was very lucky in that I didn't. And I think it definitely goes down to the school I went to.
That acting course that I ran there wasn't necessarily vocational. We weren't training kids to be actors, although a lot of them wanted to be. Yeah. It was about a performing arts experience, and that enables you to grow in many, many ways, confidence and creativity and imagination and collaboration and all that sort of thing, which people use in all sorts of occupations.
Yeah.
But of course, some of those kids did go on to train, and that was my goal, I think, to hopefully prepare those kids who wanted to act for their next level of education, tertiary education, which was yours at the VCA.
Yes, yeah, and it definitely gave me a good foundation going into training at VCA.
So going through secondary school, did you know you were there in year 7?
Yes.
Yeah. I remember little Anthony.
Yeah, I was a bit of a troublemaker.
But that's fine. Yeah. You're a larrikin.
Yes, I was a bit of a larrikin.
No harm at all, but all fun.
Yeah.
In fact, we'll get on to Jail Baby, you know, which has been part of your career. I was reading a review today, which the review said, Yangoyan's concentration and focus are absolutely remarkable.
You wouldn't have put that on my school report.
No. Secondary school. No.
Yeah.
That's just very cool. So that's something that you've developed over training. So VCA, you, I suppose, auditioned for all the acting schools once you finished.
No, I didn't audition for all of them. No. I only auditioned for NIDA and VCA. So my first year out of high school, I auditioned for NIDA. I didn't audition for VCA. And I didn't get in. I was 17 when I auditioned. And I went on to do a year of media arts and communication at UTS. So I did a degree, like a year of a uni degree. And then my second year out of uni, and because I was young when I graduated, and my second year out of uni, I had only just turned 18. So I auditioned for NIDA again, and then I thought, you know what, I might not get in, and I'd like to go to drama school reasonably soon. And you hear stories about people auditioning 5, 6, 7 times, and I didn't really want to do that. So I thought, why don't I spread my risk a little? So I auditioned for VCA as well. But I never thought to audition for WAPA. I think maybe because it was in Perth and it was just too far away from family. And QUT as well. I think I'd only really heard about VCA and NIDA. And WAPA as well, of course. But I think it was just too far away for me. And then the first time I auditioned for VCA, I got in. So I took it. Yeah. Even though it was a big move, moving away from home. But I don't regret it. I loved it, and it taught me a lot living out of home at a young age. It was good.
VCA in Melbourne, of course. So it's a great city, isn't it, Melbourne?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah. It's really, really great. I'm biased, though. I'm a Sydney boy, so I love Sydney, and I love the coastline, which is something that Melbourne doesn't have. But Melbourne is still a really great city. Great nightlife, great food, welcoming city. Just the weather's horrible. And it's got no coastline. So
two things that are very important
to me.
I'm a Victorian. I grew up in Victoria and I adore Melbourne. But I live in Sydney for a reason, I think. And even though Melbourne is, I think, the cultural capital of Australia. I don't know. They're different cities, aren't they, Sydney and Melbourne?
Yeah, they are. I feel like different periods of your life you'll live in. Like, maybe in the future I might move back to Melbourne. But for right now, I think this period of time, I think it best serves me to be here in Sydney.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Sydney. What were the artistic influences in your childhood? Was the family artistic or theatrical in any way?
No, not at all. No one was interested in the arts or knew about the arts or knew how it worked. The reason why I got into it was because Mum just wanted me to let some energy out because I was quite a hyperactive kid. And as I said, I liked making people laugh and entertaining. So she just thought, put me into drama classes with no intention. She's not a stage mum at all. She wasn't like that. She still isn't like that. She just wanted me to have an outlet for, I guess, my energy. And it turned into something that I fell in love with. Yeah. So no one. No. To answer your question, sorry. No one. No one in the family.
Does she find it surprising that you ended up being an actor?
You know what? I never asked her that, to be honest. I've never asked her, was this a surprise or did you think I was going to go down this route when I was younger? I'm not sure. I think maybe because it's been part of my life for so long and that I went to a performing arts high school, I think everyone's just gotten used to it, that like this is something that I'd like to do when there's, yeah.
Yeah. I speak to a lot of people and I ask them that question about whether their parents are happy going into the arts because it's such a an unknown, isn't it? It's sort of, there can be long periods of unemployment and of course parents are naturally concerned about that.
Yeah.
And I get a mix of responses. You know, some people, their parents were very supportive, very happy. Others, you know, my dad said, oh, I'll get something to fall back on.
Yeah.
Which I'm so glad he did, you know.
Yeah.
That was teaching. And,
yeah. Yeah, 100%. I think, yeah, that's something that obviously, you know, I'm in my mid-20s, and that's definitely something that I constantly think about. I think a lot of us constantly think about that just because there's not a heap of work in this country. And, you know, we're losing companies now. There's, you know, there was a company the other that I had worked for a few years ago that doesn't exist anymore. So it's kind of sad what's happening. But in saying that, I think if you want longevity, you have to sort of prepare to not work sometimes, and find other things to sort of keep yourself busy and give yourself some purpose, which is something that I'm still trying to find, and it doesn't happen overnight. I've worked a lot of jobs when I'm not acting that I absolutely hate. So there's a big sacrifice that comes into trying to pursue this as a career. Trying to find a balance. But that's probably a whole other conversation.
Well, we can pursue it. What do you do to stay afloat when you're not acting?
I do a lot. Like, so I was bartending for a long time. Most recently, I worked in an office. I got an office job as like a sales, like a
telesales over the phone, or
no, it wasn't. It wasn't over the phone sales. It was actually digital sales. So they were selling media space on their website, and it was something that was super, super foreign to me. I was surprised I even got the job because I was super underqualified for it. But I think I interviewed well and they knew, they could see that I was a team player and that I was willing to learn. And I learned a heap from that job. Gave me skills that I can take into other jobs in the future. But most of the time it's been hospitality. Yeah. This last year's been really great. I've been working as an actor for almost a year now. So this last year's been really good, but previous to that I've been in and out of acting gigs and I've just gone back to hospitality and or most recently this office job that I had for about six or seven months before I started Jail Baby.
What about other creative expressions? I know you're absolutely focused on your acting at the moment, but have you ever thought about potentially one day directing or maybe writing?
Yeah, 100%. Not so much writing, probably more for film. But directing more for theatre, which is interesting. I don't see myself directing a film, but I see myself maybe potentially writing one. And for theatre, I think not next year, but maybe the year after, I'd like to sort of produce my own show. I think that's something that I'm quite interested in, and bringing a team together. I think I'd get a kick out of doing that. A lot of satisfaction. And not necessarily being in the show, just bringing a team of really great creatives together and offering a platform for people to flex that muscle. So that's something I'd like to do in the future.
Well, so often this business is about creating your own work.
Yeah.
You know,
100%.
You cannot sit at home waiting for the phone to ring. You've got to.
No.
And it's also creating your own work. It's a way of giving yourself a showcase for people to come and see if you haven't been fortunate enough to be cast in one of the, you know, subsidised theatre companies' programmes.
Exactly. And a lot of the time, there's a lot of independent shows that have gotten main stage programming as well, so, which is great. It's good that that's happening more and more often.
What was the first play you saw? First professional play.
First professional. It was probably it wasn't a play. It was actually a musical.
Right.
It was Billy Elliot.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was, I think I was in year 4 or year 5, and Mum took me to see Billy Elliot. And then after that, it was Buddy Holly, the musical. And then, they're my two, like, they're the most potent memories of early theatre for me. And then after that, I think everything else is just a blur. Yeah, I've seen a lot.
Billy, when he auditions for the ballet school, I think the panel ask him, how does he feel when he dances? And he says it's like, do you remember what he says?
No, I don't.
Electricity.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
What does it feel like when you act?
This is a great question. Good question. I've never thought about this.
But there's obviously some sort of feeling all of us, which keeps us going back to it.
100%. I think there is a sense of purpose there, especially when you have people that, like, you feel a sense of purpose when you have people come in and watch you, and you're giving them a night out and allowing them, like, being part of the avenue for them to escape for a little bit. You know, same reason why we watch movies or TV shows. You know, the theatre could be a date night for someone, or a present. The ticket could be a present, or just a night out. I think it gives you that sense of purpose, and also a great sense of community, because you're working with. That's the one thing I love about theatre, that it's not a solo sport. I've asked myself all the time, would I ever do a one man show? And I don't know if I ever would, because the reason why I do theatre is to work with others and feel that sense of community, and learn from others. And not just learning about their acting, just learning about who they are as people and how they operate in the world. So that's probably the feeling that I chase.
And you're opening the door to other worlds for people as well.
Absolutely.
The Dictionary of Lost Words, you know. It was great. I was able to sort of learn about the development of the Oxford Dictionary and the suffragette movement.
I learned a lot about the Oxford Dictionary. I had obviously no idea. so it was a big lesson for me as well. You do get lucky when you do plays that also educate you, which majority of the time they do, but when you're learning about something that you never thought you'd learn about, it's kind of special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I used to love, or I still love about directing or acting. You've got to inform yourself about the world that you are entering.
Yeah.
And you go away from that production so much more knowledgeable about all sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
You otherwise probably would never have investigated.
No way, yeah. 100%.
Who are your idols, acting idols?
I don't really have any, like, well, I like, you know, I love you know, your Jim Carreys and your Tom Hardys, your Meryl Streeps, you know, all those sort of big name actors, but I think that's a bit cliche. You know, everyone says they like, you know,
Pacino.
Yeah, right, Pacino, De Niro. And of course, like, of course I think all
DiCaprio.
You know, of course all those people are absolute legends. You know, the Cate Blanchetts, like, they're phenomenal artists.
Well, they've achieved the top of the game, haven't they? And they do have a whole repertoire of mesmerizing performances captured on the screen that you can go back to again and again and again.
But I think the people that I actually admire are the people that just don't stop.
Yeah.
That's actually the people I admire. I've worked with actors that aren't household names, that aren't aren't millionaires, that don't get a bunch of recognition for their work, but they're still creating and they're still making really great work continuously. Even though it might sound a little corny, they're definitely the people, as I'm getting older, they're the people that I admire. Yeah. They're my role models. Yeah.
Looking at your CV, there is quite a diversity of plays that you've done, you know, English plays, American plays, contemporary plays, classic plays.
Yes.
By a whole range of playwrights. And do you have a favourite playwright whose work you have enjoyed performing? Or
I think Arthur Miller is also always a great one, right? A great writer. obviously very historical. But to be honest, I really like, obviously, like Susie Miller. I've performed one of her plays recently, Jail Baby. Susie Miller's a fantastic writer. Patricia Cornelius as well. I like the really grounded Australian work.
The gritty.
Yeah. I think it's a true reflection of the world that we live in. And it also appeals to the working class, which is something that isn't often explored on stage too much. So, yeah, those sort of writers. Dennis Kelly is another writer that I...
You did DNA, didn't you?
DNA, yep. Yeah. But I've read many Dennis Kelly plays over the years as well. Hopefully in the future I get to do one again. Yeah, so they're probably the writers that... or the type of writing that I really love.
Actors have to be terrific sponges. They have to, I think, absorb everything, every experience they have.
Yeah.
Do you like to people watch? Do you often?
Yeah, just... I do actually. Yeah. I do. Yeah. I do people watch. And it's how do I describe it? For me, I don't do it as an acting exercise. I just do it because I find it interesting. And I think by default, it ends up being an acting exercise. Then I'll go do something. And I'll go back to a time where I potentially have seen someone on a train or in the gym or whatever it is, and I go access that again, which is nice. It's great because it does make your characters feel like they're grounded in reality instead of trying to pull them from thin air. Mm. Yeah,
I love people watching too, and when I build a character, I often like to work from the outside in. You know, think about what they actually look like, how they walk, their mannerisms, all that sort of thing. How do you build a character?
I think majority of the time I do the same. I work from the outside in. But I guess it's like from project to project, it'll differ. You know, something like Jail Baby, I work from the inside out because it was a very intense...
Emotionally raw,
yeah. Demanding piece of work. Whereas something like The Dictionary, I definitely work from the outside in. Dictionary of Lost Words, I was the levity in the play. Well, my characters were the levity in the play, so I was sort of afforded that freedom to work from the outside in. So it just depends on the project, really. And there's not one that I prefer doing more. I just think it's whatever serves the text the best.
And the director that you're working with too, I guess every director has a different approach and style of working.
Yeah.
And you've got to serve that.
Yeah, 100%. I've been really lucky, again, to work with directors in my sort of professional career the last, you know, 3 or 4 years that have been quite understanding and really, really collaborative. Which is what I think I love in a director. You know, it shouldn't be a dictatorship. It should be a conversation, and it should be a continuous dialogue about collaborating on a piece. Where you'll hear some stories about directors really trying to take control, which is completely fair as well. I get it. That's their job. Their job is to control the room, and you know, put a play together or a piece of art. But I think it's more exciting, and you get better work out of it being collaborative. Yeah.
Well, you're on the stage of the Ros Packer at the moment, which is a big canvas. The drama theatre, I beg your pardon. Yeah, I knew it was STC. Yeah. I sort of just went there. I was there. Yes, it was the drama theatre of the Opera House. thank you for the correction. It's a big canvas. But let's talk about, you know, that work that you've done on the Griffin Theatre stage, which is almost postage stamp in comparison, but nonetheless they were big stories that you told. Dogged
yeah, it was the first one.
Fantastic. In which you played a dog.
Yeah, I played a dog. That was my first gig as well. Like my first gig out first of drama
professional
school
gig.
Professional gig out of drama school.
There was a lovely serendipity too, because I remember your HSC drama IP.
Yes.
You did Stephen Berkoff's dog.
And I played a dog.
Yeah.
I went between a man and a
dog. And his owner, which you excelled in, of course. And you excelled again in Dogged. But gee, I thought, so physically taxing. How do you prepare for a role like that?
That was, they had a big team on that, which was fantastic. It makes me smile thinking about it because I really did enjoy doing that. I guess I'm just made to play animals. But we had a movement director, and we also had a physical theatre sort of company, dance company called Force Majeure that was attached to that as well. So they had a massive team, movement directors, associate directors that were part of movement companies. And it actually kind of felt like I went back to drama school. There was a lot of, like, 1 hour of movement in the morning, a lot of choreography in the play. So it did feel like a dance as well. That was part of the preparation for that. Allowing time in the rehearsal room to train that instead of just like improvising that. It was super, super fun.
And looking after yourself so you don't get any injuries as well. Because
I did get an injury on that.
A lot of squatting.
I did. I got an injury.
What was the injury?
It was like a knee. My muscles were super tight. It was a knee injury, but it was because my quads were super tight. Because I was in a squat for seven to eight hours a day during rehearsals, for certain scenes. But a lot of the time I'm being very, very physical. So to do that 6 days a week for 8 hours during rehearsals can take its toll. And it's funny because you never think you'd get injured in theatre because we're not physical athletes, you know, we're not training like a runner or a swimmer does, but you can sometimes be put in compromising positions that surprisingly take its toll.
Well, I mean, you have to repeat them 8 times a week also.
It was, and that's what I think the physio described it as. It was like a repeat injury. I don't know what the actual term for it is, but yeah, it was because it was a repetitive sort of movement which caused the injury. But I was all good and the company took care of me, which was great.
So you had physio and masseurs?
Yeah. I had to get some physio stuff done and
Yes, also don't volunteer a movement or a gesture or something in rehearsal because you're going to have to do that eight times a
absolutely.
Week.
Absolutely.
And, you know, working with the kids at school, you know, I'll get them to do some tableau work sometimes and then I'll get them to hold the tableau while we talk about it. And often someone will just end up on one leg with their arms in the air. And you guys said, yes. Rule number one with a tableau, choose a position which you can hold for a long time.
Yeah.
We talked about people watching. So did you spend a lot of time dog watching?
Yeah, I did a lot of... I didn't get any time to go to the dog parks because it was a very intense rehearsal process. But I watched a lot of videos. And I was playing a Kelpie. So I watched a lot of videos on Kelpies. And
Red Dog.
Yes. Yeah. I actually didn't watch Red Dog for that.
Didn't you?
Probably should have. It probably came up in some YouTube clips. But I've watched Red Dog before anyway, so. That was something that I did a lot of watching. Yeah, 100%.
Did you have actors do backstories for their characters? Did you have to do a backstory for the dog?
No, I didn't do a backstory for the dog. I don't know. I sometimes don't find, depending on what it is, I don't find doing a bunch of backstory stuff helpful. I'd rather just find it on the floor and live within the given circumstances of the play because people aren't going to see what happened before that. Obviously, a little bit of backstory, you know, how old this dog, where did it come from, how long has it been on the farm, all that sort of stuff. I didn't do a hell of a lot. I did more finding on the floor and then creating that character on the floor. Yeah. But also we had a great rehearsal process. We had long enough to rehearse that I had the luxury of doing that.
Did you work on your breathing for that also? Because, you know, a dog has a different, it's a shorter.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You worked on that as well.
Yeah. Worked on that. Yeah. And I worked on that so I didn't hyperventilate as well.
I was going to say, did you get in?
Yeah. So we did, I did a lot of that as well. And I was wearing a mask for a period of the play as well. So there was a lot of, a bit of mask work as well involved. So I got a smorgasbord of things that I got to work with, and that kept it super, super interesting.
You've got a nomination for a Sydney Critics Award.
That was a nice surprise, and that was cool.
Anybody out there about to stage a production of Animal Farm?
Come in and play a pig.
Come in. Well, you might. No, you'd play the horse.
I'll play the horse. Yeah, I'll play the horse.
Play major.
Yep.
Yeah, that's more like it. Andrea James is one of the directors on Dogged, and then you...
Oh, Andrea James was the writer on Dogged.
Oh, was she?
And the director of Jail Baby.
Right, okay, because you worked with Andrea a couple of times.
Yes. Yeah.
So, which leads us into Jail Baby. An extraordinary piece of theatre, which was probably Susie Miller's spiritual sequel to Prima Facie, which she's conquered the world with at the moment.
Yes, done very
well. So, there was a lot of weight... I guess resting on the shoulders of the creatives and the actors in this, because people had an expectation that this was Susie's next play after Prima Facie. Must have been very exciting for you to be cast in it in not only one role but two roles. You played the two boys, AJ
and Seth.
And Seth.
Yeah. It was extremely stressful and nerve-wracking, especially to work with Griffin again because they're a great company. I love everyone that works Griffin within the office. I love Declan Green, who's the AD of the company. So I've worked with them before, but I'd never worked with Susie. And I'd never met Susie, but I knew a lot about Susie, obviously, through the success of her previous play. But she was really great to work with, really welcoming, super lovely, and very supportive. And I could be super transparent with her as well, which was nice because, you know, sometimes you don't feel like you can do that with certain people, but I was very transparent with Susie and she was with me, and that helped make the process a hell of a lot easier. Yeah.
Your performance was remarkable. I sat there in awe. I mean, the two boys that you created, there was such nuance with each, but also that speed of shift that you had to do in, you know, often within moments.
Yeah.
You were Seth and you were AJ or whatever, which required incredible focus and commitment from you. But you also had to, you know, go places which, you know, really dark places. Mm. How did you prepare, you know, so in case the listener doesn't know the play or hasn't seen the play, it's about a young man who goes into custody for being caught stealing, breaking and entering, and goes into a prison with much older inmates, and of course sexual violence happens within the prison, and you go into quite explicit detail about a rape through a monologue. How do you as an actor prepare for that, to deliver that, and also keep yourself emotionally safe, I guess?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. When I first read the play, it was heartbreaking, because it just, like, reading it off the page, it was intense just reading it, let alone performing it, or hearing someone else perform it. But I think my process for that was I had to remain slightly detached because I was doing 6 weeks of that show, and I couldn't, I had to use a lot of technique. I had to tap into a lot of technique that I'd never used before. So at times I felt like I was really acting. But then again, the writing is so great that I didn't really, like, that sort of faded away because the writing's so strong. So when I did feel like I was acting, that was just my insecurity coming out. I felt like the script was still so grounded that it allowed me to, I didn't have to feel everything. But in a way I did, because I was using technique to feel that.
I suppose you allow yourself once to go there and rehearse.
Yeah, 100%, and I did. Yeah, 100%. In the rehearsal room, 100%. Yeah, I did. I went to those places in the rehearsal room and it got very intense. And then I remember after a few times of doing that, I literally thought to myself, I said, I can't do that every night. No one should have to do that every night. It's just too intense, and it changes the dynamic of the show as well. And I was there to tell a story, not to indulge in a moment. So, also the director was super helpful with that as well. Like, the way that it was directed, it allowed me to tap into moments and, you know, feel things using technique while also, feeling true to to the story and to what's happening for the character at that point in time. And also having the cast, like the two actors I worked with, Lucia and Anthony, they were super, how do I say this? Like they were light in the room. And they gave me everything I needed. So when we weren't rehearsing, it was a really fun and enjoyable environment. It wasn't serious at all when we were when we weren't actually in the scene.
Yeah.
And that helps as well. Yeah. You know, there's no, you know, it's not sustainable to do a heavy play like that and then have a heavy room. You need to have levity in the room from everyone in order for that to be successful. So, which is something that did exist and still does. So yeah, that also helped. It wasn't just me, it was everyone in the room that allowed me to have that space. Yeah.
What about the end of performance? I think, you know, all actors, you know, to protect their mental health in whatever roles they're doing, need to decompress somehow. Did you have a ritual that you went through where you took off the characters of AJ and Seth, or it might have been just a mandatory drink at the bar with,
yeah,
the cast?
Well, I always, after every show, we would always debrief, me, Lucia and Anthony, and we'd always have a laugh. We'd always have a laugh, which was part of the debrief. But I think for me, it was about how we got into the show, which is very interesting. There's no formula to how any actor, you know, every actor has their own process. There's not one right way of doing anything. But for me, for this, it was how we got into the show. That was important for me. How we warmed up and how we started the show, because it reminded me that it was just a show. That's what helped me. But obviously there were some nights, I remember one night, I was doing the play and we had done the show maybe 30 odd times. And I remember that night I wanted to break down and cry in the middle of one of my scenes. And, but naturally that was going to happen. It just all caught up to me. And then I had to just refocus myself and go, okay, refocus and go back to what we were doing before, which is essentially having fun before we enter the show, which allowed me to separate the show from life. And that was our process. And they needed it as well, because it's quite heavy for them as well, to be a part of something like that. So yeah, it was going in rather than coming out. I know it's really back to front, but that's what helped me.
Yeah. Keep yourself safe.
Yeah.
So you're returning to the role.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
In January, I think.
Back
of the Griffin.
Yeah, they're bringing it back for 2 and a bit weeks. I think 2.5 weeks, almost 3.
Are you looking forward to returning to those?
Very much so.
Will there be a rehearsal period again?
Yeah, so we'll have one week of rehearsals, and then that's it. And then we go on to shows about 2 or 3 weeks after that. But I think it helps having the same team. Everyone that initially did it has signed on to do it again. So, yeah, but I'm very much excited for it. Yeah.
Yeah, good on you. Anybody listening, if you missed it, make sure you book. It's an extraordinary piece of theatre and an extraordinary performance.
Thank you.
By Mr. Yang Guilin. Opening nights. Do you have you developed a ritual yet? Is there something that you do every opening night for Superstition or?
I guess I do have rituals, but on each show the ritual's different. So like, for instance, you know, like for Dictionary, my ritual is I have to be ready, you know, a good 20 minutes before we're actually supposed to be ready. So I'm ready like 40 minutes early for Dictionary, and that's just my ritual.
You mean costume?
Costume and everything. Like I'm in costume before everyone. I've got my hair done, costume done before everyone. And in Jail Baby, I think the ritual was just, I think it was the warm up. I think the show wouldn't feel right unless we had a dance. So we used to dance before the show. We used to make fun, we used to dance. That was our ritual. And if I didn't do that, it would feel weird for me. So yeah, every show's different. Yeah. But they were my two rituals. For Dictionary, it's probably being ready way earlier than I should be. And for Jail Baby, it was having a dance before the show.
And for Dogged, you used to chase a car.
Yeah, I'd chase a car. Our ritual for Dogged, actually, we did a workout before Dogged.
Right.
We did a, like a little HIIT workout. Yeah. Blazy Best, myself, and Sandy Greenwood, we'd do like a we'd do a bit of a workout beforehand with music. And that's how we focused and got into the show. So yeah, it's quite interesting. Every show is different.
Mm.
Yeah.
Reviews, do you read reviews?
Yes, I do, but I don't read them straight away.
Right.
So I read them once I feel super comfortable with the show. And then I end up reading them. A lot of actors don't, but yeah, sometimes I just like to know what people might think. You know, yeah.
Do you like auditions?
I hate auditions.
Yeah.
I don't know any actor that likes auditioning. I really don't. You know, some auditions are really fun. If you're in love with the material, I think an audition can be super fun. You're like, oh, this is awesome. Like, even if nothing eventuates from this, it's a great outlet for me for the week, for the day, for the month. But I think that, yeah, they're just, it's a part of the business. It's it will never ever change, which is fine. That's just how it should be. But yeah, I don't love them.
I mean, and what other occupation has to go through so many job applications in a
career? Yeah.
That's what essentially it is, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And having to be pretty much close to perfect as well.
So if you don't get that job that you've auditioned for, how do you handle that rejection? Have you worked out a process yet?
I've been rejected so many times.
Actually, maybe rejection is probably not the right word, because you're not necessarily being rejected. It's just you haven't been right for the role or whatever. But if you lose out, how do you weigh that up with yourself?
I think when I was younger, like before I went to drama school, when I'd audition for things, independent things, or just things in general, it would get to me a little bit when I was in my teen years. But I think now, I've accepted that it's 110% always going to be part of the process, and that you're not the only one that's been, I guess, quote unquote, rejected, and that you always go back to the part wasn't right for me. Instead of saying, you know, it's about how you speak to yourself. I think that's, you know, if any young actors are listening, I know I'm a young actor, but younger than me.
Baby actors,
people are in their probably teens or very, very early 20s. I'd probably say it's how you speak to yourself. It's not that, you know, oh, I was terrible, or I'm never gonna work again, or I'm never gonna get it. If I can't get that, then what am I gonna get? Because that's the talk that, you know, naturally can happen very easily. It's just, it really is, I'm not right for that role. Yeah. And if it was, you know, you always go back to, if it was meant for me, it wouldn't miss me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. A senior actor once said to me that, you know, treat an audition just as another opportunity to perform.
Yeah.
You go and you learn that script and you perform it best you can.
Yeah.
And that's it. If something happens, then that's terrific.
Yeah.
If not, then you've had a chance to practice your craft.
Exactly. And I think you have to accept that if you get into this industry and you want to be an actor, you absolutely have to accept that. And like they always say, it's, you know, 95% no's, 5% yes.
Yeah.
And that's just with most people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you weren't working in the theatre and hadn't become an actor, what do you think you'd be doing?
I have no idea, really. I think I'd probably be in something that deals with people. I think I'd be in a people facing job. I'd be dealing with people every day, I think. And I'd probably be doing a job that would either be trying to make people's lives easier or try to, like, I think it's that. I think it would be that. I think it'd be like trying to make people's lives easier, helping someone, helping a business, being that person, just trying to help, I think. But I don't know what that would be.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is what you're doing now, isn't it, really? What actors do.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Will you come back and talk to me in 5 years?
100%.
Yeah. Let's hope the podcast is still going.
I'm sure it will be.
I think it'll be fascinating to talk to you in 5 years and just see where your career has gone and what your trajectory is. Do you have any ambition or goals for the next 5 years? Yeah, for a 5-year plan?
No, I don't have a 5-year plan because it's so unpredictable.
Hmm.
And sometimes I sort of go year by year.
What about film?
Yeah, of course. Like, I'd love to do more film and TV. It's just dependent on opportunity. Opportunity needs to come up, and avenues need to arise in order for me to sort of capitalize on it. But until that happens, I guess that's like where my work is sitting right now. I'm really happy. Yeah.
So you should be. You're in a fantastic spot, Ants. And thank you so much for joining the Stages podcast, episode 455.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
There you go. No, it's wonderful and a privilege to talk to a young actor starting out. So thank you very much and all the best for the future.
Thank you. Thanks.
Anthony Angoyan is presently appearing in The Dictionary of Lost Words at the Sydney Theatre Company, before a season in The Playhouse at the Victorian Arts Centre in Melbourne during February-March 2024. He also returns to the Griffin Stage in Sydney in January for a return season of Susie Miller's Jail Baby. Check the www for more information. Thanks for joining us in this episode. It's always great to have your company. I'm Peter Ayers. Keep well, keep safe. Stay warm, and I'll catch you next time on Stages.